experience, both at the college and high university and high school level. I taught from a very philosophical point of view. I basically redesigned the curriculum to teach history and literature from a philosophical point of view, got the kids involved in the program that I designed called the Great Questions Program, which were the 32 great questions relating to ethics and metaphysics and society and human nature. And then we studied in one particular course called Comparative Civilizations. I don't think they have that here, but we did up there. We studied how different cultures and civilizations had answered these questions. And then at the end of the year, guess what the kids got to do? They got to answer the questions for themselves. No right answers, no wrong answers, just on the basis of depth of your answer, using what they had learned. And the answers I got and the papers I got were inspirational. You know what most high school papers look like, term papers look like? Two or three little pages, stapled together. I got novels. I got a play. I never had a paper that was less than 40-odd pages, ever. Because the kids just... And I concluded after the first couple of experiences, kids are natural-born philosophers, just like I was. You know, there are natural-born killers. Well, there's the movie, there's natural-born philosophers. Mm-hmm. That's everybody. And I've decided ultimately that all human beings are. And so, and I think this works because of something that Abdu'l-Bahá points out in some answered questions, is because the human soul is inherently rational. And that's actually Abdu'l-Bahá's definition of the ration of the soul in some answered questions. I think it's page 208 or 228. I always get confused. The human soul is the rational soul, which he says is what distinguishes us from the animal. And consequently, the rational soul wants answers, rational answers, answers that can be explained. And as a matter of fact, Abdu'l-Bahá says that. In this age, the peoples of the world need the arguments of reason. Now, that doesn't mean reason is the only way to attain knowledge, but it is certainly one that is essential to all human beings. We are all rational beings. And later he says, in one of those great quotes around which you could write a whole book on the reason versus faith issue, if a question is found to be contrary to reason, faith and belief in it are impossible. Notice that, impossible. And there is no room but wavering and vacillation. And that is just that is fallout. Those are consequences of having a rational soul. And of course, doing that with a rational soul, we not only can critique others, we can also, above all, learn to critique ourselves. I used to have a wonderful Jesuit professor in my undergraduate years. He used to say, "Don't believe everything you think." And you know, over the years, I've had more than 30 years to ponder that. He's so right. That's what our problem is. You know, animals are like that. They believe everything they think. They think you're an enemy. Chomp. You never thought, could I be wrong? There's no self-critical faculty. My dog, whom I love dearly, never have I ever seen him sit down at the end of a long day and ask himself, have I been a good dog today? Have I lived up to my doggish potential? Did I really bark as well as I could have? And whatever. They're just satisfied with themselves. So this is all very integral to being a spiritual, developed human being. And of course, this does not exclude the heart, because that gets the whole topic, so I sort of bumped over that, but I did want to point that out. The heart is not excluded. You'll notice that very often in the writings of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, the heart and the mind are mentioned together, in very close proximity. They're meant to be some kind of interaction, So if philosophical education, especially for young people, but everybody, because Abdu'l-Bahá at one point says that all the peoples of the world should learn science and philosophy, and he says they must be taught, and I have the exact quote on that will be in the paper that you can have at the end of the session if you wish. So how are we going to, how are we going to do this? And so how can we bring about what Shoghi Effendi calls a change of heart, a reframing of all our conceptions, and a new orientation to our activities? Think of that, a changing of heart, a reframing of all our conceptions. There's criticism and self-critique and rational question asking, and I'll have more to say about that. Remember, this is the only religion that has a feast of questions. You know, like a feast of... There's a message in there. And a new orientation to our activities. In other words, you're going to need self-analysis of your own thoughts, and of course the thoughts of others as well. And I got a couple of things to say before I go on about philosophy. Among Baha'is, I've noticed that over the years, my one addiction in life, if these people ever go out of business, I'm in serious difficulty. Oh, you want to? Sure, okay. Go right ahead. And then you can follow along, actually. You know, there's some misconceptions among Baha'is about what philosophy actually is, because very many Baha'is dismiss philosophy as one of those things that begins in words and ends in words. And this is a misconception. I'm going to show you some quotes here. Of course we want ultimately to get to action. You know, Baha'u'llah does say, let deeds, not words, be your adorning. But notice that in the Baha'i faith, Abdu'l-Baha also tells us, knowledge and understanding should precede action, should come before action. In other words, not acting without knowledge and understanding. Although a person of good deeds is acceptable at the threshold of the Almighty, yet it is first to know and then to do. This is at the bottom of page 4. And then he goes on and he gives an example there of talking about animals. And then again, he has that quote there, all mankind must be given a knowledge of science and philosophy. And then he says, philosophy develops the mind. And then he gives, Abdu'l-Baha provides us a very interesting definition of philosophy, because you could write books about this, because right there he's at war with a very, very influential trend in modern philosophy that influences all the universities and colleges and sociologists and social workers and everybody, called postmodernism. And Abdu'l-Baha says, philosophy consists in comprehending the reality of things as they exist, according to the capacity and the power of man. Okay? And the idea of comprehending reality is a very controversial idea in our time, that there is a reality to comprehend, let alone that human beings could ever begin to comprehend it. And then Shoghi Effendi, in that similar vein, writes, philosophy as you study it and later teach it is certainly not one of the sciences that begins and ends in words. Fruitless excursions into metaphysical hair-splitting is meant, not, get this, not a sound branch of learning like philosophy. Okay, and he goes on, and he later gives further things that people can do, correlate them with modern schools of thought. And that's really the big project that I'm on. I think of it as building bridges to as many schools of thought as is humanly possible. But, you know, there are limits to that too, of course. So the other thing that reinforces the importance of philosophy is the extensive presence of philosophy in the Baha'i writings. And this is especially true when we read Paris Talks, Selections from the Writings of Abdu'l-Baha, and Promulgation of Universal Peace. And I always love using this little paragraph here from Some Answered Questions, because it illustrates perfectly what I'm trying to get at. Some think that the body is the substance and exists by itself, and the spirit is accidental and depends upon the substance of the body. Although, on the contrary, the rational soul is the substance and the body depends upon it. If the rational soul, that is to say, if the accident, that is to say, the body, be destroyed, the substance, the spirit, remains. That's the basis of his entire proof of the immortality of the human spirit. Mm. And he's using very technical philosophical language drawn primarily from the Aristotelian tradition, which Abdu'l-Baha relies on to a great deal, or I wouldn't say relies on, but confirms. I wrote a paper on that, and he confirms some of the Aristotle's basic philosophic insights in some of the language there. So from there on, I think we said enough about that. The foundations of environmentalism in the Baha'i writings. I'm going to put these two ideas together, the importance of philosophy and environmentalism. Long before environmental issues came to the forefront, Shoghi Effendi issued a statement that not only lays out the philosophical foundations of environmentalism, but also establishes a guideline for pursuing it effectively and intelligently. And here's what he writes. We cannot segregate the human heart from the environment outside us and say that once one of these is reformed, everything will be improved. Man is organic with the world. His inner life molds the environment and is itself also deeply affected by it. The one acts upon the other, and every abiding change in the life of man is the result of these mutual reactions. And you could write a book, and I'm going to outline basically a book later in this paper on that. What he says is you can't separate. Human beings are part of the natural world, and the human heart as well, same with the mind. And he says that we are in an interaction, or for some of you, this word might ring all sorts of bells, we are in a dialectical relationship with the environment, where the environment influences us and we respond, which in turn influences the environment and goes round and round and round in a cycle like that to a certain point. And of course, this declaration that we're affected by the environment and are part of it, which is the foundation for Baha'i environmentalism, is simply an application of a logical principle that Abdul Baha sets out in Some Answered Questions. I have here Baha'i World Faith, but it's actually Some Answered Questions. For all beings are connected together like a chain, and reciprocal help, assistance, and influence belonging to the properties of things are the causes of existence, development, and growth of created things. So we're all interconnected. Everything is interconnected. And then a chain. Anybody ever heard of the concept of the great chain of being?
Waddington.
Yes. There's a famous book by a guy called Lovejoy, which is about the great chain of being. That is the concept on which all medieval social theory, law, metaphysics is based. On that, and Abdul Baha basically confirms that basic idea. He references that idea, the great chain of being. And so the Abdul Baha's assertion portrays the universe as dialectical in nature. Baha'i environmental philosophy is built on the ontological foundation that humankind and the natural environment are aspects of a single cosmic process. Okay? And Shoghi Effendi draws special attention to our inner life. He says, we affect the environment affects our inner life, and our inner life affects the environment. Well, if that's true, then it would, obviously, if you want to change the way human beings affect the environment, you must first change their inner life. You must, in other words, you must change the way they feel, you must change their spirituality, but you must also change the way they think. Our thoughts and beliefs, assumptions, concepts, and attitudes, feelings, and values generate and shape our actions in the external world, and this, of course, influences the natural and social environment. Because our social environment, the kind of our thoughts influence the kind of actions we have. And that, in turn, influences the kind of the social environment that we live in, the kind of society we live in, the kind of laws we need or make necessary for society. And this, of course, in turn, will affect the natural environment too. It's just another chain of causation going through. Did you have a question?
Didn't Baha'u'llah say that our thoughts are reality?
Yes.
I mean, that's how important our thoughts are.
Yes. I would agree. Our thoughts are our reality. Take as many as you like.
It takes several, so
it's a lot. So we need a change of heart, a reframing of all our conceptions, and a new orientation, says Shoghi Effendi in another quote. And then he adds, the inward life of man as well as his outward environment have to be reshaped if human salvation is to be secured. So any effort to try to save the environment, the natural environment in this case, by strictly external means, social legislation, reforms of the economic things. People got to remember, a lot of economic ideas aren't new. There's some economic ideas suggested this morning about the Fed, if you listen to one of the second talk about the Federal Reserve and its power to create money, etc., etc. I don't know if anybody else thought it was new, but I just went, my God, he's talking social credit from the 1920s. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. It's just social credit, rehashed social credit from the 1920s. It's difficult to have new ideas. If establishing a healthy relationship to the natural environment depends on developing a new and better inward spirit, how can this be done? And this, of course, is where how philosophy can improve our inward life. And this is where we get into the first thing that it can do. Actually, it can be summed up in one phrase that then needs to be unpacked. We can say, philosophy encourages the habit of thoughtfulness. Who would seriously contend that the world does not need more thoughtful people? You know, in fact, most of the problems in the world are caused by, not by people who are intellectually, who are stupid, who have low IQs. They're caused by people who have just fine IQs, who never stop to think. Does anybody know who Dr. Mengele was? Dr. Josef Mengele, the angel of death at Auschwitz. My mother was Jewish, so I grew up with this sort of information. Or the angel of death at Auschwitz, who had a medical doctorate degree, plus a junior degree in philosophy, I'm ashamed to say. Yet he still operated on unanesthetized patients, and did all sorts of unspeakable horrors, not because he was stupid, because he wasn't. He was just thoughtless, also heartless, but today we're going to focus on the thoughtless part of it. And that's a common human problem. He'd never even come to the very simple point that most children get to if they're healthy, of asking themselves, could I be wrong? Hadn't got there yet. He was in an adult body with an adult brain, but so thoughtless that he hadn't even asked himself that fundamental question. Okay, and so in the habit of thoughtlessness, in the habit of thoughtfulness, we, Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, set out some very specific guidelines in order to help create and nurture our inward life. These are, we must be impartial, we must set aside hearsay, we must be just and examine the truth for ourselves. We must not let others predetermine the answers for us, no matter how many degrees they have. A PhD who is wrong is still wrong, and he's not right just because he's got a PhD. And a person with no degree who is right is right. And the fact that he may be illiterate doesn't mean he's not right. He's still right. This has nothing to do, none of those kinds of authority matter in clear and impartial thinking. Now, true, we pay a little more attention to Aristotle than we do to Ian, for good reason. Aristotle was a lot brighter and did more important work. But Aristotle also was wrong on some things. You know, he thought that women were incompletely formed men embryos. Now, this is wrong. It's just, you know, not that he was mean to women. He wasn't. He was very nice, and he actually included his wife in his will, and included his mistress too, mind you.
I have a point. You know, just looking in terms of consultation, what's the authority for anybody's conclusion? It has to be based in understanding.
Yes.
And not any other authority. I mean, you can't vote for something just because I said, hey, this is the way we ought to think about this. The authority has to be in group understanding.
Well, we have, after consultation, I'll have more to say about consultation because
okay,
it forms an important part of this because it has a fairly long tradition. So we must set aside bias and prejudice. And so the writings are very concerned with the quality of our inner environment. Then I get to the next section, part of which is a little technical, but I thought everybody would love to have a list of how many kinds of questions are there. There's more than there are here, but this is a good chunk of them. Questioning, the art of systematic questioning. That's why we have a feast of questions. Because if you're not questioning, you're not thinking. The two just come together. Albert Einstein became a famous genius physicist because he asked himself questions to which everybody else thought they had the answers. Nobody else but this little guy in Switzerland or Germany, and then Switzerland, was asking himself, is time really the same for everybody? Because he noticed, as he said, that time spent, an hour spent talking to a pretty girl went like a second, and an hour sitting on a hot stove, a second spent sitting on a hot stove was like an hour. He also asked him, is space really like a bucket? Does space really contain things? And he decided it didn't. And from there on in, that is, those very simple ideas, along with a couple of images of trains, are the source of relativity theory. So the idea of questioning is important. And one of the things that, if you want to improve your inner intellectual life, is you can, and this is a lifelong project, you can start to master the types of questions that there are and apply them not just to other people's thought, but above all to your own. Remember Father Dr. Mackenzie, and if you ever said just Father Mackenzie, that was wrong. This had to be Father Dr. Mackenzie. Jesuits have no sense of humor about that sort of thing. And it's don't believe everything you think. So I'm going to go through some of the lists of questions and then apply them to one of the writings. You'll have to excuse my shaking hand. I had a stroke 6 years ago, and this is a little souvenir that got left behind. So, and questions have a lot of benefits. First of all, they make us free. When you question, you are no longer enslaved to somebody else's point of view. You may discover that they were right, but you will have discovered it on your own by thinking through it for yourself, and that makes you free. Another thing that questions can actually do, it forces you to look at ideas from a completely different point of view, which, of course, when we do that emotionally from the heart, we call it empathy. But the intellectual correlate of empathy from the heart is the ability to think problems, ideas through from a completely different point of view. And above all, it's one of the most important things it does. It forestalls the tendency to literal reading. As I'm sure you're all aware, there is nothing more maddening than literalists. Remember, you guys know what Calvin and Hobbes is, the cartoon?
Yeah. Oh yeah, the tiger.
Yes, where the little girl asks Calvin, I think that cloud looks like a pink flamingo or whatever, and he says, to me it looks like a bunch of ice crystals suspended in the air. And then she says, everybody hates a literalist. which is exactly how it is. But literalism, when applied to religion, can be devastating, as we all know. And a lot of the conflicts that we have, the religious conflicts in the world, are caused by nothing more than literalism. And one of the way, and you can't be literal, a literalist, if you start systematically questioning yourself. For example, Abdu'l-Bahá, when he speaks of Adam and Eve, says, if the literal meaning of the story were attributed to a wise man, certainly all would logically deny that this arrangement, this invention, could have emanated from an intelligent being. And that's pretty strong stuff. He says, if you take this literally, it cannot have been an intelligent being that actually did that sort of thing. And Baha'u'llah says, the purpose of the prophetic words was not the outward or literal meaning, but the inner symbolical significance. And of course, again, if you read Abdu'l-Bahá's interpretation of some answered questions, then what you see is, especially in the first half of the book, these very symbolical interpretations, which cut through all of these theological mystifications. And if any of you have ever gone to a Christian university, in my case, a Catholic university, you will know what gyrations and twists and turns you can go through trying to square the circle. It can't be done. At some point you just give up and say, it doesn't work. It can't be literal. And again, if you ask questions about those kind of things, you will be forestalled in that habit. The other big sinners, by the way, in literal reading of religion are the new atheists. I'm sure some of you have heard of them. You know, Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, Dennett, among the most notorious. You notice how they all insist on taking religious scripture absolutely literally, whether it's biblical or Quranic or Buddhistic in Harris's case. They're total absolute literalists. They haven't come beyond that point. So on page 13, if you're following along, I've got a whole list of questions. And I've got 10 minutes to get through the rest of this because I want to have you guys get some questions. I won't bore you by reading the list, but they are there with some examples. And then on page 14, I have a quotation from Gleanings, which says, "Know thou that every created thing is a sign of the revelation of God. Each according to its capacity is and will ever remain a token of the Almighty, inasmuch as He, the Sovereign Lord of all, hath willed to reveal His sovereignty in the kingdom of names and attributes. Each and every created thing hath, through the act of the divine will, be made a sign of His glory." Now, if we start questioning this systematically, if we ask, what is the purpose of this question, and purpose questions is one type of question, we may come to a variety of answers. They're not mutually exclusive, such as the sacralization of nature as a divine creation. Nature has been made sacred, which is one of the very things we're trying to fight for in the whole idea of our vision of the environment, that nature is sacred, or that provides a direct proof of God's existence, or deals with important ethical questions. If we ask a clarification question about proximity and remoteness, we will learn very quickly that time and space don't apply, because to God, you know, if you can't say I'm 6 feet 4 inches, sorry, I'm not metric yet, whatever from God, it's a meaningless statement. By the way, if you want to torment somebody who's a real materialist about the mind, and they want to tell you the thought system and the material process, ask them if the thought of a 30-foot high triangle is bigger than the thought of a 3-inch high triangle. Just a little fun stuff to
bend your mind.
That's right. If you ask, so it can ask about hidden assumptions. You know, all of our thoughts have hidden assumptions. When you say, I'm going to walk the dog, honey, you are assuming there is a dog, there is honey, that a thing as motion is possible, in other words, movement through time and space, that the earth will actually be under your feet, that you actually exist. You're writing a little metaphysical textbook. You just didn't realize it yet. But you're making all of these assumptions. And when you want to analyze writing and thinking, and that's part of improving your inner environment, you have to question all these assumptions. Then we get to the last part of this, and I'll make this quick. Another important part is that dialectics in the Baha'i writings. The Baha'i writings are very dialectic, and in simplest possible terms, dialectic is when you have two things, such as man and nature, interreacting, mutually interreacting. And of course, and it takes two forms. In its classical form, it's the Socratic dialogue. If you've read Socrates' dialogue, Socrates doesn't push a particular point of view. He simply asks questions again and again and again. And they ask Socrates questions, and they try to arrive at the truth. The purpose is to arrive at the truth. It's really a very early non-spiritual form of consultation that comes there. And, of course, we are told as Baha'is that consultation is one of the thought forms we are to practice, you know, assiduously, as much as we can, to the greatest degree possible, because that is what will ultimately make us different. And it'll make us different by making us think differently. And if we don't think differently, we can't expect to act differently. That's one of the definitions of insanity, doing the same things again and again and expecting a different result every time. No, it doesn't work that way. If you do the same thing again and again and again, in the same situation, of course, you're going to get the same result again and again. So we have consultation. Consultation understows empathy, compassion, understanding, It bestows humility, because you have to sit there and somebody else may disagree with your idea. We don't want to use the word trash, but they may critique it very severely. And you're going to have to sit there and, of course, realize it's not your idea anymore and detach yourself from it and listen, because you're going to ask yourself that awful question, could he be right? And you can't escape anymore. And if that becomes a habit, then you're thinking differently. And by changing the inner environment, eventually we will come to obvious realizations. The world cannot live at the current pace of materialist consumption for everybody without something going seriously wrong. And suddenly those things will start to become more meaningful. So, I say here, the human and or natural environment become one of the partners in the consultative dialectical process. And finally, to really take this into the outer depths, here's a research paper for somebody who wants to do it. The writings, there's a second level of dialectics that's associated with a philosopher called Hegel, but also with Karl Marx and Engels. I'm not getting to that age. And I grew up with Marx and Engels in my mother's milk. My parents were convinced Marxist-Leninists until my mother died, and then my father, 3 years later, becomes a Baha'i and repudiates his whole life's work before that. So very, very interesting. I always say, if my dad can become a Baha'i, you know, the man who used to teach us little kids, we'll have a better world when we strangle the last clergyman with the guts of the last capitalist. You know, but there is a lot of in dialectical thought, we have to consider both aspects of the process, not just one or the other. It's not linear thoughts. And throughout the writings, we see this spread out. For example, in the previous statement that I read you from Shoghi Effendi, where he says, man is organic with the world. His inner life molds the environment and is itself also deeply affected by it. Right at the beginning, I've used that quote several times. That he's describing a dialectical process of interaction of things. And of course, dialectical thought depends on the idea that everything is always in process or in motion. And there's a quote from Abdu'l-Bahá that says, know that nothing which exists remains in a state of repose. That is to say, all things are in motion. And I go on from there. But there are also other intriguing hints about that. And I'm throwing this out as a way of exploring for a new way of thinking among Baha'is. And that is the Hegelian interpenetration of opposites. For example, Baha'u'llah says in a very intriguing quote in Tablets of Baha'u'llah, the world of existence came into being through the heat generated from the interaction between the active force and that which is the recipient. These two are the same, yet they are different. If ever there was a dialectical statement, it's right there. They're the same, but different, and they're interacting, and they're interacting on each other, and the world of being came out of that. Or this is okay. And so, and a dialectic also requires a certain amount of conflict or opposition. And in the Baha'i writings, we have these oppositions. We have a whole long series of them. For example, human beings have an animal part and a spiritual part, and they interact, and as long as, of course, the goal is to have the spiritual part in control, it's not to eliminate the animal part, but to have it under control. And so we have these dialectical opposites there with the spiritual. Also, you can also say there's a dialectical process going on between the individual and the community. Between, and this again, I've got quotes in the writings, because I want to get this done in the next 2 minutes so we can have questions or walk out or whatever. between potentiality and actuality, what you could be and what you are. That's the essence of all of literature and tragedy, for starters. That's everybody's life. Deep inside of us, if somebody got you to write out everything you could possibly write about your life, every little secret detail, and we typed it out on computer printer paper to fill this room cubically, and I pointed to this room and I say, "So that's you." You'd say, "No, it's more than that." That's because you can sense that inner potential. No. That's, even if it were all true, that's still the past. But I'm not the past yet. I've got a future. There are great things inside of me that I want to get out. I want to write the great American novel. Doesn't everybody? See, so we also have a dialectic going on between matter and form. And this is from 58, Abdu'l-Bahá's Unanswered Questions. The son is born from substance and form, which can be compared to the father and the mother, and it is absolute perfection. But the darkness hath neither substance nor form, neither father nor mother. And that is a metaphorical explanation of why evil doesn't exist. It has no substance and no form. It is not an entity in itself. But everything that is real does have a substance and a form, or matter and form. So the matter-form dialectic pair also informs the teaching of progressive revelation. In progressive revelation, we have the eternal substance of religion, right? And then in a constant dialectical interaction with the local conditions, times, the degrees of material progress, climate, whatever, right? And they're in constant interaction. And why does a religion become outdated in a sense? The substance doesn't become outdated. The essence of religion doesn't become outdated. But the outward form does. And a new form is brought about by the manifestation of God. So there we have that same dialectic proceeding in the writings. And then, of course, we have the whole male-female dialectic. And very interesting, the writings tell us. One cannot be perfected unless the other is also perfected. So no matter what the U.S. Army promises, you cannot be all you can be if you're a guy until all women are also all they can be as women. That was cute, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's nice.
Why would women want to be in the army?
I need you to talk to my younger daughter. I'm only dad. So another dialectical pair is individual and community. I've mentioned that. Also liberty and true liberty. Abdu'l-Bahá and Baha'u'lláh both talk about the interaction between our desire for liberty and what is actually true liberty. You know, what in the 18th century they called rational liberty. Not quite the same idea, but similar. Liberty that is not so destructive on the community. The most important thing that dialectical thinking does, perhaps for us, is to look for the unseen, hidden unities between apparent opposites. So in other words, it focuses our vision on unity, the similarities that things contain, instead of only on the parts where they clash. Because ultimately, if you took Hegel, you got the thesis, you know, and then you have the opposite of the thesis, the antithesis, and then they combine, the chaff gets blown away, so to speak, like the outward form of religion, and then you have the synthesis. And the Baha'i faith, as we know, and Abdu'l-Bahá, I think I have the quote here where he says so, the Baha'i faith, is, Baha'u'llah says, is the religion where all other religions will find their highest possibilities realized. We are the synthesis. Hegel would have said, aha, I understand. Maybe not. Hegel was a very strict Lutheran, but you got to feel sorry for him. Dying of cholera after taking a bath is... Little kid, I tried to warn my mother about that, but she wasn't listening. So, So we have that in progressive revelation. I think I've yadded on long enough. So if there are any questions.
You just the dialectic, you were talking about the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. It's where is it that you get something more from that just more than just synthesizing what is there, but something that's greater than the sum of those?
Well, never mind what Hegel would say. I think in the Baha'i writings, the manifestation brings that something more when it's applied to progressive revelation. But also remember, everything has a lot more potential in it than we actually see, that are actually apparent. And this is, of course, led to this concept of emergent evolution. So, you know, you have hydrogen, you have water. No matter what, there is no way of calculating in advance what are the characteristics going to be of whatever happens when you join hydrogen and oxygen. What we get is water, which has characteristics which are absolutely unpredictable. They're obviously potential there, but we just can't be aware of them. And they emerge. In the case of progressive evolution, let's say it would be the manifestation who brings that extra new measure. That's what the manifestation says he does.
But on this, on that, in terms of like man and woman,
yes,
a very personal level, you have maybe the synthesis is humanity, male and female, and humanity then is more complete through that union,
yeah,
on a spiritual level, not just talking about creating another being. But
no, spiritual. Yeah, that's a definite possibility. I think you really have a paper there. Because you're taking an idea, you've caught the football, and are now running with it. And I think you got something going there. Yes, sir?
Well, I was going to say, I think one way which is very interesting to sort of see the way that we speak as Baha'is, we've been talking about this whole conference, this idea of false dichotomies.
Speak up so everybody hears.
I was saying in this conference, I've heard a lot of the talk of false dichotomies in our communities as well. And it's interesting to think about the way to sort of take an abstract concept like dialectic, and think about what it could actually do in the way we think about our communities. So, for example, we're talking about, the relationship between, you know, scholarship and teaching. This is a false dichotomy. You don't have to persist in that. But for those who exist in this dichotomy where they're standing in one position and they see something which is opposed or is, you know, opposing to this position they're trying to protect, at some point you look deeper and you realize actually both these activities are expressions of a single thing underneath that. And by sort of seeking what was underneath that, we come up with this new perspective of like, well, these are both elements of service. These are both elements of this one thing underneath it. So you gain an ability to sort of interact with a broad spectrum of possibilities, which in the world present themselves as opposites according to our current level. But in this sort of path of understanding, you seek the unity underneath contradictions, and this is sort of that idea of a dialectic.
That's exactly what I'm trying to get at. When you learn how to think in new ways, you're going to be raised to the new level, you're going to see new things in the writings. I mean, I couldn't have seen that in the writings years ago. Yes, sir?
I was just thinking to you that, for example, the interaction of the environment on us is not the physical environment per se, that's now, it would have been thousands of years ago, but it's the information environment that's constantly affecting our thinking every day. But what reorientates ourselves to that, I think, are things like prayer and meditation, reflection on the writing, which helps us to filter out necessarily the information that we're getting. Trying to make some sense out of that, at the same time, really be able to have critical analysis of that information so that we are able to just discard it and allow ourselves to move forward. If not, we would simply be being shaped by the information constantly without critical sort of processing of that. The last thing I just wanted to say was that it seems to me that the issues of things like prayer, which my religious tradition that I came from, that we prayed when we needed to, rather than seeing prayer as the necessary ingredient to sort of reforming and reshaping the soul's ability to respond. I think within the writings, when I'm thinking about the obligatory prayer, it's possible that something like that is so critical to our own ability to perceive what is real. If we didn't have that, we would really be disadvantaged. In other words, we'd be missing out on a natural process of understanding things in a more critical way.
Yeah, I would think so. And prayer would include meditation. Remember, Abdu'l-Bahá says that a creature devoid of meditation cannot even be called human. I mean, that is an incredibly strong statement. So he doesn't prescribe the form of meditation and prayer or any of these other things. But, you know, it's up to us to choose to make use of them. Yes, sir? Did you have your hand up?
Well, now that you say it, I could have.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was scratching my forehead.
Oh. Well, it was inspirational what you were doing.
Well, no. I think one worry about the idea of the Hegelian dialectic that the communists fell into was something that's hidden in this dialectical thinking, and that's the idea of teleology. Because Aristotle and his teleology play very prominently in the idea of the dialectic, that all these dialectics are playing into some grand plan. And I think the trap that people fall into is thinking that they know in advance where this is heading and that where it's going. In other words, the Marxists said, yes, there are dialectics that are complex, but hey, we know in advance that we're going to have the communist utopia as the final end product of this. So we're, you know, going to kill off so many millions of people, so many people in the gulags to get there. Or any other thing. I mean, you can say that the world historical process is leading to whatever end goal that you want to necessarily see taking place. And Hegel himself thought that the quaint little 19th century
Prussia
was the end of history, you know, and it turned out to be a little bit off.
A little bit off.
Yeah, and I think that, so one worry about this whole, and I think we have to be worried about that ourselves as Baha'is, is to not begin to think that we know in advance the end product of where we're heading.
Well,
to keep an open mind. And that's what I think consultation really is all about, is not thinking that, well, you know, all these people are fighting, but we do really know in advance where we're going. So, because that closes off your mind. But to realize that you really are a part of the dialectic that you're heading into, and that, I think, is what keeps your mind open.
I would say the Baha'i writings do actually tell us where history is going. They say we're on a process toward world unity. Now, they don't, and the unification of the world into a commonwealth, some kind of a global commonwealth, wisely enough, in line with your remarks about consultation, they have not provided us with an exact constitution of a future world commonwealth, etc., etc. But they are very clear. We do know where history is going. The unification of the human race is the goal. So the teleology is there. I wrote a whole paper on teleology in the Baha'i Faith. It's on my website. It's very much there, and led to a very jealous remark by somebody to me, a fellow teacher once. He said, you know, it must be nice to be so calm about world events because when you know where this is all going. And I said, yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I'm very concerned, but I'm not going to panic because I know where this is going. I think this gentleman the first name is.
I think you brought up a very important point, and I want to kind of build on what was said and what was originally stated in terms of assumption and questioning assumptions. I think that aside from questioning assumption, I think often you get engaged too strongly and wholeheartedly in questioning assumption is perhaps more important than that is making new assumptions possible. And if you look at, for example, the whole notion of Baha'u'llah's revelation, or every revelation that has come, it has really not been about questioning assumption, but making new assumptions possible and then enabling us to work towards, or work based on the assumption. I think what you mentioned in terms of not knowing really where we're going, say where we're heading, and your answer to that, and I think there's a really interesting statement from The Guardian, and I'm sure most of us know that. The Guardian says that all at this time, I'm actually paraphrasing, eventually to attempt to destroy the records. Exactly. They're seeing a glimmer of the light, but even the most sincere follower of Baha'u'llah, any attempt from the most sincere follower of Baha'u'llah in order to explain what it is, the Guardian says is a lie, you know, it's futile. to do that.
That's right. So the general goal is there, but the details aren't. Without the general goal, who would be a Baha'i?
So what I was trying to get at was that I think Baha'u'llah has allowed us, enabled us to make new assumptions about the world, about humanity. Where this assumption is going to take us in general, I don't think we really quite know. The same thing that we really even don't know where this 5-year plan is going to take us. Every week we discover new stuff. So I think that's an important differentiation.
If somebody were to do a paper on that, I'm sure you'd have to look at some of the differences. I mean, Hegel wasn't anticipating everything, but it's very prescient that his work is prescient, and the Baha'i writings seem to have picked up. I don't think picked up, but they converge with these writings. You, sir,
Would you like to say anything more?
Okay.
I just want to say that Jesus taught 2,000 years ago that humans should love each other. So we have nowhere over hidden. But are we loving each other? I don't think so. So, who knows?
No, okay. One last question. Somebody who hasn't asked before yet, put up your hand where you want to be. The lady in the back there.
I think we're doing the same thing. It interests me. May I have just a moment? In economics, there was at one time a very popular theory, and it was institutionalism. And the idea was picked up that society becomes quite static. And it's hit by technological change, and the technological change causes society to adapt in a different form or way. And then once it adapts, it's hit by new technology. What is interesting to me, in listening to the discussions, that I am thinking, well, we will have, after the clash, of adjusting society to a one world unity, we don't go beyond that. And Baha'u'llah actually does when he mentions the next manifestation of God and what will happen, but he never says what is going to happen again. It will be your dialectic, of course.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've got to get ready for our next speaker, and that's Mikhail. Now, tell me, Sergei?
Yeah, that's me. You can't pronounce it any way you like.
No, it makes a difference. I used to tell my kids, you know, Kluge or Kludge. Kluge. I said, no, you're boogie with Kluge. That worked. Okay, so the next talk will be in 15 minutes with Mikhail Sergei.
Recorded this if you want to get any of that.